Good morning, welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The last best chance to strike, that's how the US President Donald Trump is describing the timing of America's military action on Iran, which has killed the Ayatollah Khamenei and other senior regime officials and triggered retaliatory attacks from Iran across the region. The US President has been making his first White House appearance since the military action began. Barbara Miller joins me from our Washington Bureau. Barb, there's been criticism of the president that he hasn't been sufficiently clear in making the case for the strikes, for the war against Iran. Did he do that today?
I think he had another stab at it. And what he said, this was him addressing a ceremony at the White House, a medal ceremony. And he said that Iran had attempted to rebuild its nuclear capabilities, even though they'd been warned not to. And then he said that the US was also extremely worried about Iran's ballistic missile program, and that very soon, he said, Iran would have had missiles capable of reaching our beautiful America. Now, many people would dispute that, but that's what the president said today at the White House. And he said that there were four objectives in Operation Epic Fury: to destroy those missile capabilities, to destroy Iran's navy, to stop it obtaining nuclear weapons, and to ensure that it couldn't fund regional proxies. What he didn't mention there was the issue of regime change, and that's an issue, as you know, we've been getting mixed messages from the White House on as to whether that is the objective of this operation. And he had some interesting things to say, Mel, about the timeline.
Right from the beginning, we projected 4 to 5 weeks, but we have capability to go far longer than that. We'll do it. Whatever somebody said today, they said, oh, well, the president wants to do it really quickly. After that, he'll get bored. I don't get bored. There's nothing boring about this.
And then these comments went on for a few minutes. And then Donald Trump kind of distracted himself, started talking about the curtains in the room, and then started talking about this project where he's building a ballroom and how his wife Melania didn't like the noise from it, but he thought it was a beautiful noise. So quite a surreal appearance in some ways by the president at this very serious event and giving these comments about his rationale for essentially starting a war, but then going on to one of his pet subjects, the ballroom.
As you say, curious when it is such a serious situation, which is underlined by the fact that there have been American personnel killed, and now we have confirmation that more managed to escape after a friendly fire incident. Can you tell me more about that circumstance in Kuwait?
Yeah, this involved three fighter jets, three F-15s, and they were brought down. There's some pretty dramatic footage of at least one of them spiraling towards the ground. That's in Kuwait. We're told that all six crew on those three fighter jets were able to eject before the planes hit the ground and that they are all okay. As you say, we now know that another military member has died. That brings to four the number of casualties so far. Now, nevertheless, the Secretary of War, as he's now called, Pete Hegseth, really lashed out in an appearance he made earlier, saying that this war would not drag on.
To the media outlets and political left screaming endless wars, stop. This is not Iraq. This is not endless. I was there for both.
A reference there to Pete Hegseth's previous service as a National Guard officer. He said this was the opposite of an endless war, that it was precise, it was laser focused, and really trying to stress that it wouldn't drag on in the way that the Iraq war did. But again, Mel, we heard from him and we've heard consistently in the past few days that the administration is letting the American people know that they should expect more casualties. And of course, if that starts happening at scale, that's when the political case for this action becomes a lot more difficult.
Barbara Miller there. The first funerals for Israelis killed in Iranian retaliatory strikes have begun to be held overnight after a missile hit a synagogue in a town outside of Jerusalem. And in the last few hours, Israel has expanded its strikes on Lebanon. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
As the afternoon sun casts long shadows over Beirut's southern suburbs, Israeli warplanes struck the city and beyond. Israel claims it was targeting Hezbollah sites less than 24 hours after the Iranian-backed militant group entered the fray, firing rockets over its southern border into Israeli territory. Lebanon's Prime Minister Nawaf Salam earlier saying his government rejected Hezbollah's decision to attack Israel.
It affirms that the decision of war and peace is exclusively in its hands, which necessitates the immediate prohibition of all of Hezbollah's security and military activities.
Hezbollah says it's striking Israel to avenge the death of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, over the weekend. Israel in turn declaring Hezbollah's leader, Naim Qassem, a target for elimination. On Beirut's famous corniche, the ABC met people who'd fled the southern suburb of Dahia as it was being pummeled the night before. Among them was Zainab Nasser, sitting in her pyjamas.
The house started shaking. We woke up to see what was happening. We escaped because our apartment is very high up on the 10th floor.
Im Mohammed was also there. She was critical of the Lebanese authorities for not providing assistance to those who left and feared what was to come.
How do I feel? There's a plane above us. I'm scared. I'm terrified. What can we do? We're like everyone else. We don't have the means to rent somewhere else. We have no money.
The death toll from the overnight attacks had risen to 31 by early evening, but that was before another heavy bombardment across Beirut and Lebanon's south. The situation in Iran even more dire after 3 days of intense strikes hitting thousands of targets.
Based on our field reports, our estimate is that 1,500 people died so far, which includes 200 civilians across Iran.
Irina Moradi is from the organization Hengal, which monitors human rights in Iran and Kurdistan.
They targeted military bases. Unfortunately, most of these bases are inside the towns and the cities, very close to populated areas. So we are expecting the number of casualties to rise in coming days.
Not all of those deaths were as a result of airstrikes. Some were shootings by Iranian security forces. It's difficult to get information out of Iran given restrictions on the press and the reprisals for citizens who share details outside the country. In Israel, scenes of carnage and heartbreak as a result of Iranian retaliatory strikes are clear to see. In Beit Shemesh, outside Jerusalem, the grief poured from one woman whose sister was among nine who were killed on Sunday afternoon. Her funeral was being held as warning sirens rang out for more incoming missile barrages. Among the mourners were Sarah Wiseman and her son, Avi.
I think it hasn't sunken in yet. Really terrible tragedy. And she was a special woman. She was a person who gave. She volunteered. She was an incredible mom and just an incredible human being. A great loss.
My friends are pretty scared. We're all scared. And we have the IDF to protect us. The rest, it's on God. You need to trust and believe in him. They will protect you.
Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, visited the site of the strike before the funerals began. And he had a warning to groups across the region not to follow Hezbollah's lead and attack Israel.
And I recommend not to any proxy, not to even dare think that they will start another war with us.
While speaking in very strong terms about others, Israeli leaders are also facing condemnation that these strikes in conjunction with the United States are illegal, that the countries didn't go through the appropriate processes before launching them.
Mr. President, how do you respond to criticism from the UN that this is a breach of international law?
As President Herzog walked off, he turned and insisted there was no breach. This is Matthew Doran in Beit Shemesh, reporting for AM.
Some of the world's biggest travel hubs have halted operations in recent days, leaving more than 100,000 Australians stranded in the Middle East. Many are still waiting to find out how and when they can safely return home. Meanwhile, other Australians visiting family abroad are unsure of what to do as the conflict widens. Analysts say the attacks on infrastructure such as airports are a sign of desperation from the Iranian regime. Isabel Masali reports.
Brisbane man Pierre Nemi has spent the last year caring for elderly relatives in Lebanon. The plan was to return to Australia about now. An escalating war has changed that.
In a lot of ways, it's in disbelief. I do feel I am cautious. I am aware of what could possibly happens in terms of if, for example, Israel is to strike right across the country.
He's staying in northern Lebanon and believes he's safe as Israel and Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah trade strikes in the widening war with Iran. But he knows the trip home won't be easy.
There could be some difficulties, like especially if I'm to leave via the airport, that would be probably something I would avoid doing. But there are other means to leave, I guess.
Melbourne resident David Willey was headed to Europe for a holiday when his plane diverted to Oman. He's sharing a hotel room with another stranded passenger. At this stage, he'll be waiting until Saturday for a flight.
No baggage, no one can tell us anything at all. Sort of even just to get our bags and things like that. There's definitely lots of people, like, you know, wearing the same clothes every day and needing their medication and things like that.
Central Coast woman Sandra Ray was travelling for business but is stuck in Dubai.
My company will probably try and get me out via land, either to Saudi Arabia to see if we can get a flight. I'll probably go home because the meeting that I was meant to be doing presentations to is already started today.
The situation has many travellers like her feeling uneasy.
There has been some loud bangs, some really quite loud bangs, which the staff have said that are drones. There's many drones apparently which have come over but have been intercepted by the UAE Defence Force. I haven't seen any explosions, but definitely hear them. And you get a phone warning as well. So when the airport was actually hit, we were all standing in line and everybody's phone just went off. Absolutely went off. We were all standing in line at the hotel. I think most people had already left the airport.
Ian Parmiter is a Middle East expert at the Australian National University. He says Iran's attacks on civilian infrastructure are a sign of desperation.
Previously, Iran has attacked US bases in the region and obviously attacked Israel directly. But now what they're trying to do, quite clearly, is to put pressure on the Gulf states, the Arab Gulf states, to say to the Americans, stop the war, this is hurting us.
In 2025, US strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities became known as the 12-day war. But given the stated aim of these latest attacks is regime change, he expects the unrest could last a while longer.
What we have now is a much wider war with attacks on civilian infrastructure in Arab states and in Israel as well, which really means that the very large number of Australians who visit the Middle East are in a situation where they are potentially in harm's way.
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is encouraging Australians to register with them if they're in Israel, Iran, Qatar or the United Arab Emirates.
Isabel Masali there, reporting with Sarah Temevska. Samira Moyedin is a Toronto-based broadcaster and an expert on Iranian politics. Samira Moyedin, thank you very much for speaking to me this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, Iranian media has confirmed the deaths of many senior commanders in the armed forces, as well as the Ayatollah. Are the strikes that we've seen so far enough to shake the regime's hold of Iranian politics?
I don't think so. The system that the Iranian government has is not built on just one man. It is a very entrenched system with clerical rule based on sort of economic patronage and military might. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is really at this point just entrenching themselves and taking over. Even though we're seeing sort of these top commanders eliminated, Iran has always, you know, had this contingency plan in place. You don't just shout death to Israel, death to America without expecting that at some point, you know, those same countries will retaliate. And, you know, let's remember that this supreme leader who was killed, Ali Khamenei, was 86 years old. They already had a successor lined up at this point. So the dismantling of this system is going to take a lot more than just getting rid of some figureheads.
Communication within Iran and to the outside world is somewhat limited at the moment. But what do we know at the moment about the mood in Iran, about the level of support for regime change and the public response to the US and Israeli strikes?
You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, as you point out, their access is very spotty right now. I was able to get a WhatsApp message from a friend who told me she was leaving Tehran and going north, but the message that I sent back never got to her. But what's happening right now is a sort of rallying around the flag that I think, you know, when this first started, let's remember that a month ago, people were in the streets in Iran and were met with brutal violence by the government. However, these past 3 days, we're seeing a lot of people being killed. We're seeing residential buildings being struck, a primary girls' school being hit. And I think this is really changing the narrative. Whereas you saw sort of jubilation when Khamenei was killed, I think that euphoria is now dying down. And Iranians are really asking themselves, well, what's the end game here? You know, what is to come after this? Because as these buildings, you know, are crumbling and with every airstrike that is killing innocent civilians, the euphoria of sort of thinking, oh, you know, we might be rid of this repression, it is dying down, and a weird sort of reality is setting in of perhaps a war of attrition taking place.
Samira Moyedin, thank you very much for speaking to me this morning.
Thank you.
Samira Moyedin is a Toronto-based broadcaster and an expert in Iranian politics. In Australia, some seaside communities are wondering whether climate change will make their homes unsafe to live in. In Switzerland, they're asking the same thing in the mountains. In one of the world's wealthiest nations, entire alpine villages are being evacuated as melting glaciers and thawing permafrost destabilise the Alps. It's created climate refugees in the heart of Europe, and it's forced a reckoning: how much is too much to pay to protect the Alps? Foreign correspondent Naomi Selvaratnam has this report from the Swiss Alps.
In the Swiss Alps, a special festival is underway. Cowbells echo through the valley as farmers celebrate the return of their cattle from the high mountain pastures in a centuries-old tradition. These mountain communities are at the heart of Switzerland's identity. Farmer Axel grew up in these valleys.
I'm a mountain person. A week ago, we were at the sea on holidays, but I do always miss the mountains, and the green landscape is very beautiful.
What would Switzerland be without its mountains?
It wouldn't be Switzerland.
But Switzerland's mountains are changing fast. The Alps are warming at roughly twice the global average, putting them on Europe's front line of climate change. Glaciologist Matthias Huss says while natural disasters are nothing new in the Alps, their frequency and severity is being exacerbated by a warming climate.
This is what we are seeing here, that there are many, many places that just transform into dangerous spots. So I can't tell which mountain is the next to collapse, but I'm quite sure there will be another similar event somewhere in the Alps.
Last year, the world watched in shock as the ancient alpine village of Blotten was destroyed when the mountains gave way. Danny Rittler lost his home in the disaster.
Everything we had built over the past 35 years was there, and from 1 second to the next, it was gone.
Rebuilding Blotten will cost hundreds of millions of dollars for a village of just a few hundred people. That steep price has triggered a national reckoning over how much Switzerland is willing to spend to defend its mountains. Climate scientist Reto Canutti says it's a tough decision.
Switzerland spends about almost $3 billion preventing natural disasters, and then the rebuilding is another, I don't know, half a billion maybe. So it really becomes expensive for a relatively small number of houses and people.
Climate scientist Ritu Kanuti, ending that report by Naomi Selvaratnam. And you can watch the full story on tonight's episode of Foreign Correspondent at 8 p.m. on the ABC. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump says the war with Iran will continue until all his goals are achieved, and he's warned more US troops are likely to die. But if one of the aims is regime change, how can the US president achieve that without troops on the ground? Today, Hussein Abish from the Arab Gulf States Institute on why the war is unlikely to go as Trump planned. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.